In the story of mathematics, the ancient Greeks stand out as the inventors of the manner in which modern mathematics is carried out, through axioms, proofs, theorems, more proofs, more theorems, and so on. In the 1930s, however, the Czech-American mathematician Kurt Gödel, a friend of Einstein's, showed this approach to be somewhat deficient. Most of mathematics, he demonstrated, must be inconsistent or else must contain truths that cannot be proved. Still, the march of mathematics has continued unabated in the Greek style, the style of Euclid. The Greeks, geniuses in geometry, created a small set of axioms, statements to be accepted without proof, and proceeded from there to prove many beautiful theorems detailing the properties of lines, planes, triangles, and other geometric forms. From this knowledge they discerned, for example, that the Earth is a sphere, and even calculated its radius. One must wonder why a civilization that could produce a theorem such as Proposition 29 of Book 1 of Euclid's Elements, and I quote, "A straight line falling on two parallel straight lines makes the alternate angles equal to one another, the exterior angle equal to the interior and opposite angle, and the interior angles on the same side equal to two right angles." Did not create a theory showing that if you throw two dice, it would be unwise to bet your Corvette on their both coming up a six. Actually, not only didn't the Greeks have Corvettes, but they also didn't have dice. They did have gambling addictions, however. They also had plenty of animal carcasses, and so what they tossed were astragali, made from heel bones. An astragalus has six sides, but only four are stable enough to allow the bone to come to rest on them. Modern scholars note that because of the bone's construction, the chances of its landing on each of the four sides was not equal. They are about 10% for two of the sides and 40% for the other two. A common game involved tossing four astragali. The outcome considered best was a rare one, but not the rarest, the case in which all four astragali came up different. This was called a Venus throw. The Venus throw has a probability of about 384 out of 10,000, but the Greeks, lacking a theory of randomness, didn't know that. The Greeks also employed astragali when making inquiries of their oracles. From their oracles, questioners could receive answers that were said to be the words of the gods. Many important choices made by prominent Greeks were based on the advice of oracles, as evidenced by the accounts of the historian Herodotus, and writers like Homer, Aeschylus, and Sophocles. But despite the importance of astragali tosses in both gambling and religion, the Greeks made no effort to understand the regularities of astragali throws. Why didn't the Greeks develop a theory of probability? One answer is that many Greeks believed that the future unfolded according to the will of the gods. If the result of an astragalus toss meant, marry the stocky Spartan girl who pinned you in that wrestling match behind the school barracks, a Greek boy wouldn't view the toss as the lucky or unlucky result of a random process. He would view it as the gods' will. Given such a view, an understanding of randomness would have been irrelevant. Thus, a mathematical prediction of randomness would have seemed impossible. Another answer may lie in the very philosophy that made the Greeks such great mathematicians. They insisted on absolute truth, proved by logic and axioms, and frowned on uncertain pronouncements. In Plato's Phaedo, for example, Simmias tells Socrates that arguments from probabilities are impostors, and anticipates the work of Kahneman and Tversky by pointing out that, unless great caution is observed in the use of them, they are apt to be deceptive, in geometry and in other things too. And in Theaetetus, Socrates says that any mathematician who argued from probabilities and likelihoods in geometry would not be worth an ace. But even Greeks who believed that probabilists were worth an ace might have had difficulty working out a consistent theory in those days before extensive record-keeping, because people have notoriously poor memories when it comes to estimating the frequency, and hence the probability, of past occurrences. Which is greater, the number of six-letter English words having N as their fifth letter, or the number of six-letter English words ending in ing? Most people choose the group of words ending in ing. Why? Because words ending in ing are easier to think of than generic six-letter words having N as their fifth letter. But you don't have to survey the Oxford English Dictionary, or even know how to count, to prove that guess wrong. The group of six-letter words having N as their fifth letter includes all six-letter words ending in ing. Psychologists call that type of mistake the availability bias because, in reconstructing the past, we give unwarranted importance to memories that are most vivid and hence most available for retrieval. The nasty thing about the availability bias is that it insidiously distorts our view of the world by distorting our perception of past events and our environment. For example, people tend to overestimate the fraction of homeless people who are mentally ill because when they encounter a homeless person who is not behaving oddly, they don't take notice and tell all their friends about that unremarkable homeless person they ran into. But when they encounter a homeless person stomping down the street and waving his arms at an imaginary companion while singing "When the Saints Go Marching In," they do tend to remember the incident. How probable is it that of the five lines at the grocery store checkout, you will choose the one that takes the longest? Unless you've been cursed by a practitioner of the black arts, the answer is around 1 in 5. So why, when you look back, do you get the feeling you have a supernatural knack for choosing the longest line? Because you have more important things to focus on when things go right. But it makes an impression when the lady in front of you, with a single item in her cart, decides to argue about why her chicken is priced at $1.50 a pound when she is certain the sign at the meat counter said $1.49. One stark illustration of the effect the availability bias can have on our judgment and decision-making came from a mock jury trial. In the study, the jury was given equal doses of exonerating and incriminating evidence regarding the charge that a driver was drunk when he ran into a garbage truck. The catch is that one group of jurors was given the exonerating evidence in a pallid version. The owner of the garbage truck stated under cross-examination that his garbage truck was difficult to see at night because it was gray in color. The other group was given a more vivid form of the same evidence. The owner of the garbage truck stated under cross-examination that his garbage truck was difficult to see at night because it was gray in color. The owner remarked his trucks are gray because it hides the dirt. What do you want? I should paint them pink? The incriminating evidence was also presented in two ways, this time in a vivid form to the first group and in a pallid version to the second. When the jurors were asked to produce guilt-innocence ratings, the side with the more vivid presentation of the evidence always prevailed, and the effect was enhanced when there was a 48-hour delay before rendering the verdict, presumably because the recall gap was even greater. By distorting our view of the past, the availability bias complicates any attempt to make sense of it. This was true for the ancient Greeks, just as it is true for us. But there was one other major obstacle to an early theory of randomness, a very practical one. Although basic probability requires only knowledge of arithmetic, the Greeks did not know arithmetic, at least not in a form that is easy to work with. In Athens in the 5th century BC, for instance, at the height of Greek civilization, a person who wanted to write down a number used a kind of alphabetic code. The first 9 of the 24 letters in the Greek alphabet stood for the numbers we call 1 through 9. The next 9 letters stood for the numbers we call 10, 20, 30, and so on. And the last 6 letters, plus 3 additional symbols, stood for the first 9 hundreds, 100, 200, and so on to 900. If you think you have trouble with arithmetic now, imagine trying to subtract one set of these symbols from another. To make matters worse, the order in which the ones, tens, and hundreds were written down didn't really matter. Sometimes the hundreds were written first, sometimes last, and sometimes all order was ignored. Finally, the Greeks had no zero. The concept of zero came to Greece when Alexander invaded the Babylonian Empire in 331 BC. Even then, although the Alexandrians began to use the zero to denote the absence of a number, it wasn't employed as a number in its own right. In modern mathematics, the number zero has two key properties. In addition, it is the number that, when added to any other number, leaves the other number unchanged. And in multiplication, it is the number that, when multiplied by any other number, is itself unchanged. This concept wasn't introduced until the 9th century by the Indian mathematician Mahavira. Even after the development of a usable number system, it would be many more centuries before people came to recognize addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division as the fundamental arithmetic operations, and slowly realized that convenient symbols would make their manipulation far easier. And so it wasn't until the 16th century that the Western world was truly poised to develop a theory of probability. Still, despite the handicap of an awkward system of calculation, it was the civilization that conquered the Greeks, the Romans, who made the first progress in understanding randomness. The Romans generally scorned mathematics, at least the mathematics of the Greeks. In the words of the Roman statesman Cicero, who lived from 106 to 43 BC, the Greeks held the geometer in the highest honor. Accordingly, nothing made more brilliant progress among them than mathematics. But we have established as the limit of this art its usefulness in measuring and counting. Indeed, whereas one might imagine a Greek textbook focused on the proof of congruences among abstract triangles, a typical Roman text focused on such issues as how to determine the width of a river when the enemy is occupying the other bank. With such mathematical priorities, it is not surprising that while the Greeks produced mathematical luminaries like Archimedes, Diophantus, Euclid, Eudoxus, Pythagoras, and Thales, the Romans did not produce even one mathematician. In Roman culture, it was comfort and war, not truth and beauty, that occupied center stage. And yet precisely because they focused on the practical, the Romans saw value in understanding probability. So while finding little value in abstract geometry, Cicero wrote that probability is the very guide of life. Cicero was perhaps the greatest ancient champion of probability. He employed it to argue against the common interpretation of gambling success as due to divine intervention, writing that the man who plays often will at some time or other make a Venus cast. Now and then, indeed, he will make it twice, and even thrice, in succession. Are we going to be so feeble-minded, then, as to affirm that such a thing happened by the personal intervention of Venus, rather than by pure luck? Cicero believed that an event could be anticipated and predicted, even though its occurrence would be a result of blind chance. He even used a statistical argument to ridicule the belief in astrology. Annoyed that although outlawed in Rome, astrology was nevertheless alive and well, Cicero noted that at Cannae in 216 BC, Hannibal, leading about 50,000 Carthaginians and allied troops, crushed the much larger Roman army, slaughtering more than 60,000 of its 80,000 soldiers. "Did all the Romans who fell at Cannae have the same horoscope?" Cicero asked. "It all had one and the same end." Cicero might have been encouraged to know that a couple of thousand years later, in the journal Nature, a scientific study of the validity of astrological predictions agreed with his conclusion. The New York Post, on the other hand, advises today that, as a Sagittarius, I must look at criticisms objectively and make whatever changes seem necessary. In the end, Cicero's principal legacy in the field of randomness is the term he used, probabilis, which is the origin of the term we employ today. But it is one part of the Roman code of law, the Digest, compiled by Emperor Justinian in the 6th century, that is the first document in which probability appears as an everyday term of art. To appreciate the Roman applications of mathematical thinking to legal theory, one must understand the context. Roman law in the Dark Ages was based on the practice of the Germanic tribes. It wasn't pretty. Take, for example, the rules of testimony. The veracity of, say, a husband denying an affair with his wife's toga maker would be determined not by hubby's ability to withstand a grilling by prickly opposing counsel, but by whether he'd stick to his story even after being pricked by a red-hot iron. Bring back that custom and you'll see a lot more divorce cases settle out of court. And if the defendant says the chariot never tried to stop, but the expert witness says the hoofprints show that the brakes were applied, Germanic doctrine offered a simple prescription. Let one man be chosen from each group to fight it out with shields and spears. Whoever loses is a perjurer and must lose his right hand. In replacing, or at least supplementing, the practice of trial by battle, the Romans sought in mathematical precision a cure for the deficiencies of their old arbitrary system. Seen in this context, the Roman idea of justice employed advanced intellectual concepts. Recognizing that evidence and testimony often conflicted, and that the best way to resolve such conflicts was to quantify the inevitable uncertainty, the Romans created the concept of half-proof, which applied in cases in which there was no compelling reason to believe or disbelieve evidence or testimony. In some cases, the Roman doctrine of evidence included even finer degrees of proof, as in the church decree that a bishop should not be condemned except with 72 witnesses. A cardinal priest should not be condemned except with 44 witnesses. A cardinal deacon of the city of Rome without 36 witnesses. A subdeacon, acolyte, exorcist, lector, or doorkeeper except with 7 witnesses. To be convicted under those rules, you'd have to have not only committed the crime but also sold tickets. Still, the recognition that the probability of truth in testimony can vary, and that rules for combining such probabilities are necessary, was a start. And so it was in the unlikely venue of ancient Rome that the systematic set of rules based on probability first arose. Unfortunately, it is hard to achieve quantitative dexterity when you're juggling VIIIs and XIVs. In the end, though Roman law had a certain legal rationality and coherence, it fell short of mathematical validity. In Roman law, for example, 2 half-proofs constituted a complete proof. That might sound reasonable to a mind unaccustomed to quantitative thought, but with today's familiarity with fractions, it invites the question, if 2 half-proofs equal a complete certainty, what do 3 half-proofs make? According to the correct manner of compounding probabilities, not only do 2 half-proofs yield less than a whole certainty, but no finite number of partial proofs will ever add up to a certainty because to compound probabilities, you don't add them. You multiply. That brings us to our next law, the rule for compounding probabilities. If 2 possible events, A and B, are independent, then the probability that both A and B will occur is equal to the product of their individual probabilities. Suppose a married person has, on average, roughly a 1 in 50 chance of getting divorced each year. On the other hand, a police officer has about a 1 in 5,000 chance each year of being killed on the job. What are the chances that a married police officer will be divorced and killed in the same year? Well, according to the principle, if those events are independent, the chances would be roughly 1/50th times 1/5000th, which equals 1 over 250,000. Of course, the events are not independent. They are linked. Once you die, darn it, you can no longer get divorced. And so the chance of that much bad luck is actually a little less than 1 in 250,000. Why multiply rather than add? Suppose you make a pack of trading cards out of the pictures of those 100 guys you've met so far through your internet dating service. Those men who in their website photos often look like Tom Cruise, but in person more often resemble Danny DeVito. Suppose also that on the back of each card you list certain data about the men, such as honest, yes or no, and attractive, yes or no. Finally, suppose that 1 in 10 of the prospective soulmates rates a yes in each case. How many in your pack of 100 will pass the test on both counts? Let's take honest as the first trait. We could equally well have taken attractive. Since 1 in 10 cards lists a yes under honest, 10 of the 100 cards will qualify. Of those 10, how many are attractive? Again, 1 in 10, so now you are left with 1 card. The first 1 in 10 cuts the possibilities down by 1/10, and so does the next 1 in 10, making the result 1 in 100. That's why you multiply. And if you have more requirements than just honest and attractive, you have to keep multiplying, so, well, good luck. Before we move on, it is worth paying attention to an important detail. The clause that reads, if two possible events, A and B, are independent. Suppose an airline has one seat left on a flight and two passengers have yet to show up. Suppose that from experience the airline knows there is a 2 in 3 chance a passenger who books a seat will arrive to claim it. Employing the multiplication rule, the gate attendant can conclude that there is a 2/3 × 2/3, or about a 44% chance, she will have to deal with an unhappy customer. The chance that neither customer will show and the plane will have to fly with an empty seat, on the other hand, is 1/3 × 1/3, or only about 11%. But that assumes the passengers are independent. If, say, they are traveling together, then the above analysis is wrong. The chances that both will show up are 2 in 3, the same as the chances that one will show up. It is important to remember that you get the compound probability from the simple ones by multiplying only if the events are in no way contingent on each other. The rule we just applied could be applied to the Roman rule of half-proofs. The chance of two independent half-proofs being wrong are 1 in 4. So two half-proofs constitute 3/4 of a proof, not a whole proof. The Romans added where they should have multiplied. There are situations in which probabilities should be added, and that is our next law. It arises when we want to know the chances of either one event or another occurring, as opposed to the earlier situation, in which we want to know the chance of one event and another event both happening. The law is this. If an event can have a number of different and distinct possible outcomes, A, B, C, and so on, then the probability that either A or B will occur is equal to the sum of the individual probabilities of A and B and the sum of the probabilities of all the possible outcomes, A, B, C, and so on, is 1. That is 100%. When you want to know the chances that two independent events, A and B, will both occur, you multiply. If you want to know the chances that either of two mutually exclusive events, A or B, will occur, you add. Back to our airline. When should the gate attendant add the probabilities instead of multiplying them? Suppose she wants to know the chances that either both passengers or neither passenger will show up. In this case, she should add the individual probabilities, which, according to what we've just calculated, would come to 55%. These three laws, simple as they are, form much of the basis of probability theory. Properly applied, they can give us much insight into the workings of nature and the everyday world. We employ them in our everyday decision-making all the time, but like the Roman lawmakers, we don't always use them correctly. It is easy to look back, shake our heads, and write books with titles like The Rotten Romans. But lest we become unjustifiably self-congratulatory, I shall end this chapter with a look at some ways in which the basic laws I've discussed may be applied to our own legal system. As it turns out, that's enough to sober up anyone drunk on feelings of cultural superiority. The good news is that we don't have half-proofs today, but we do have a kind of 999,000 over 1 million proof. For instance, it is not uncommon for experts in DNA analysis to testify at a criminal trial that a DNA sample taken from a crime scene matches that taken from a suspect. How certain are such matches? When DNA evidence was first introduced, a number of experts testified that false positives are impossible in DNA testing. Today, DNA experts regularly testify that the odds of a random person's matching the crime sample are less than 1 in 1 million or 1 in 1 billion. With those odds, one can hardly blame a juror for thinking, throw away the key. But there is another statistic that is often not presented to the jury, one having to do with the fact that labs make errors, for instance, in collecting or handling a sample, by accidentally mixing or swapping samples, or by misinterpreting or incorrectly reporting results. Each of these errors is rare, but not nearly as rare as a random match. The Philadelphia City Crime Laboratory, for instance, admitted that it had swapped the reference sample of the defendant and the victim in a rape case, and a testing firm called Cellmark Diagnostics admitted to a similar error. Unfortunately, the power of statistics relating to DNA presented in court is such that in Oklahoma, a court sentenced a man named Timothy Durham to more than 3,100 years in prison, even though 11 witnesses had placed him in another state at the time of the crime. It turned out that in the initial analysis, the lab had failed to completely separate the DNA of the rapist and that of the victim in the fluid they tested. And the combination of the victim's and the rapist's DNA produced a positive result when compared with Durham's. A later retest turned up the error, and Durham was released after spending nearly 4 years in prison. Estimates of the error rate due to human causes vary, but many experts put it at around 1%. However, since the error rate of many labs has never been measured, courts often do not allow testimony on this overall statistic. Even if courts did allow testimony regarding false positives, how would jurors assess it? Most jurors assume that given the two types of error, the 1 in 1 billion accidental match and the 1 in 100 lab error match, the overall error rate must be somewhere between, say, 1 in 500 million, which is still, for most jurors, beyond a reasonable doubt. But employing the laws of probability, we find a much different answer. The way to think of it is this. Since both errors are very unlikely, we can ignore the possibility that there is both an accidental match and a lab error. Therefore, we seek the probability that one error or the other occurred. That is given by our sum rule. It is the probability of a lab error, 1 in 100, plus the probability of an accidental match, 1 in 1 billion. Since the latter is 10 million times smaller than the former, to a very good approximation, the chance of both errors is the same as the chance of the more probable error, that is, the chances are 1 in 100. Given both possible causes, therefore, we should ignore the fancy expert testimony about the odds of accidental matches and focus instead on the much higher laboratory error rate, the very data courts often do not allow attorneys to present. And so the oft-repeated claims of DNA infallibility are exaggerated. This is not an isolated issue. The use of mathematics in the modern legal system suffers from problems no less serious than those that arose in Rome so many centuries ago. One of the most famous cases illustrating the use and misuse of probability in law is People v. Collins, heard in 1968 by the California Supreme Court. Here are the facts of the case as presented in the court decision. On June 18, 1964, about 11:30 a.m., Mrs. Juanita Brooks, who had been shopping, was walking home along an alley in the San Pedro area of the city of Los Angeles. She was pulling behind her a wicker basket carry-all containing groceries and had her purse on top of the packages. She was using a cane. As she stooped down to pick up an empty carton, she was suddenly pushed to the ground by a person whom she neither saw nor heard approach. She was stunned by the fall and felt some pain. She managed to look up and saw a young woman running from the scene. According to Mrs. Brooks, the latter appeared to weigh around 145 pounds, was wearing something dark, and had hair between a dark blonde and a light blonde, but lighter than the color of defendant Janet Collins's hair, as it appeared in the trial. Immediately after the incident, Mrs. Brooks discovered that her purse, containing between $35 and $40, was missing. About the same time as the robbery, John Bass, who lived on the street at the end of the alley, was in front of his house watering his lawn. His attention was attracted by a lot of crying and screaming coming from the alley. As he looked in that direction, he saw a woman run out of the alley and enter a yellow automobile parked across the street from him. He was unable to give the make of the car. The car started off immediately and pulled wide around another parked vehicle so that in the narrow street it passed within 6 feet of Bass. The latter then saw that it was being driven by a male Negro, wearing a mustache and beard. Other witnesses variously described the car as yellow with an off-white top, and yellow with an eggshell white top. The car was also described as being medium to large in size. A few days after the incident, a Los Angeles police officer spotted a yellow Lincoln with an off-white top in front of the defendant's home and spoke with them, explaining that he was investigating a robbery. He noted that the suspects fit the description of the man and woman who had committed the crime, except that the man did not have a beard, though he admitted that he sometimes wore one. Later that day, the Los Angeles police arrested the two suspects, Malcolm Ricardo Collins and his wife Janet. The evidence against the couple was scant, and the case rested heavily on the identification by the victim and the witness, John Bass. Unfortunately for the prosecution, neither proved to be a star on the witness stand. The victim could not identify Janet as the perpetrator and hadn't seen the driver at all. John Bass had not seen the perpetrator and said at the police lineup that he could not positively identify Malcolm Collins as the driver. And so it seemed the case was falling apart. Enter the star witness, described in the California Supreme Court opinion only as an instructor of mathematics at a state college. This witness testified that the fact that the defendants were a Caucasian woman with a blonde ponytail and a Negro with a beard and mustache who drove a partly yellow automobile was enough to convict the couple. To illustrate its point, the prosecution presented this table, quoted here verbatim from the Supreme Court decision. It lists characteristics and their individual probability. Partly yellow automobile, 1 in 10. Man with mustache, 1 in 4. Negro man with beard, 1 in 10. Girl with ponytail, 1 in 10. Girl with blonde hair, 1 in 3. Interracial couple in car, 1 in 1,000. The math instructor called by the prosecution said that the product rule applies to this data. By multiplying all the probabilities, one concludes that the chances of a couple fitting all these distinctive characteristics are 1 in 12 million. Accordingly, he said, one could infer that the chances that the couple was innocent were 1 in 12 million. The prosecutor then pointed out that these individual probabilities were estimates and invited the jurors to supply their own guesses and then do the math. He himself, he said, believed they were conservative estimates, and the probability he came up with employing the factors he assigned was more like 1 in 1 billion. The jury bought it and convicted the couple. What is wrong with this picture? For one thing, as we've seen, in order to find a compound probability by multiplying the component probabilities, the categories have to be independent, and in this case, they clearly aren't. For example, the table quotes the chance of observing a Negro man with beard as 1 in 10, and a man with mustache as 1 in 4. But most men with a beard also have a mustache, so if you observe a Negro man with beard, the chances are no longer 1 in 4 that the man you observe has a mustache. They are much higher. That issue can be remedied if you eliminate the category Negro man with beard. Then the product of the probabilities falls to about 1 in 1 million. There is another error in the analysis. The relevant probability is not the one stated before, the probability that a couple selected at random will match the suspect's description. Rather, the relevant probability is the chance that a couple matching all these characteristics is the guilty couple. The former might be 1 in 1 million, but as for the latter, the population of the area adjoining the one where the crime was committed was several million. So you might reasonably expect there to be 2 or 3 couples in the area who match the description. In that case, the probability that a couple who matched the description was guilty, based on this evidence alone, which is pretty much all the prosecution had, was only 1 in 2 or 1 in 3. Hardly beyond a reasonable doubt. For these reasons, the Supreme Court overturned Collins's conviction. The use of probability and statistics in modern courtrooms is still a controversial subject. In the Collins case, the California Supreme Court derided what it called trial by mathematics, but it left the door open to more proper applications of mathematical techniques. In the ensuing years, courts rarely considered mathematical arguments, but even when attorneys and judges don't quote explicit probabilities or mathematical theorems, they do often employ this sort of reasoning, as do jurors when they weigh the evidence. Moreover, statistical arguments are becoming increasingly important because of the necessity of assessing DNA evidence. Unfortunately, with this increased importance, has not come increased understanding on the part of attorneys, judges, or juries. As explained by Thomas Lyon, who teaches probability and the law at the University of Southern California, few students take a probability in law course, and few attorneys feel it has a place. In law, as in other realms, the understanding of randomness can reveal hidden layers of truth, but only to those who possess the tools to uncover them. In the next chapter, we shall consider the story of the first man to study those tools systematically. Chapter 3. Finding Your Way Through a Space of Possibilities. In the years leading up to 1576, an oddly attired old man could be found roving with a strange, irregular gait up and down the streets of Rome, shouting occasionally to no one in particular, and being listened to by no one at all. He had once been celebrated throughout Europe, a famous astrologer, physician to nobles of the court, chair of medicine at the University of Pavia. He had created enduring inventions, including a forerunner of the combination lock and the universal joint, which is used in automobiles today. He had published 131 books on a wide range of topics in philosophy, medicine, mathematics, and science. In 1576, however, he was a man with a past but no future, living in obscurity and abject poverty. In the late summer of that year, he sat at his desk and wrote his final words, an ode to his favorite son, his oldest, who had been executed 16 years earlier at age 26. The old man died on September 20th, a few days shy of his 75th birthday. He had outlived two of his three children. At his death, his surviving son was employed by the Inquisition as a professional torturer. That plum job was a reward for having given evidence against his father. Before his death, Gerolamo Cardano burned 170 unpublished manuscripts. Those sifting through his possessions found 111 that survived. One, written decades earlier and, from the looks of it, often revised, was a treatise of 32 short chapters. Titled The Book on Games of Chance, it was the first book ever written on the theory of randomness. People had been gambling and coping with other uncertainties for thousands of years. Can I make it across the desert before I die of thirst? Is it dangerous to remain under the cliff while the earth is shaking like this? Does that grin from the cave girl who likes to paint buffaloes on the sides of rocks mean she likes me? Yet until Cardano came along, no one had accomplished a reasoned analysis of the course that games or other uncertain processes take. Cardano's insight into how chance works became embodied in a principle we shall call the law of the sample space. The law of the sample space represented a new idea and a new methodology, and has formed the basis of the mathematical description of uncertainty in all the centuries that followed. It is a simple methodology, a laws of chance analog of the idea of balancing a checkbook. Yet with this simple method, we gain the ability to approach many problems systematically that would otherwise prove almost hopelessly confusing. To illustrate both the use and the power of the law, we shall consider a problem that, although easily stated and requiring no advanced mathematics to solve, has probably stumped more people than any other in the history of randomness. As newspaper columns go, Parade magazine's Ask Marilyn has to be considered a smashing success. Distributed in 350 newspapers and boasting a combined circulation of nearly 36 million, the question and answer column originated in 1986 and is still going strong. The questions can be as enlightening as the answers, an unscientific Gallup poll of what is on Americans' minds. For instance, when the stock market closes at the end of the day, why does everyone stand around smiling and clapping, regardless of whether the stocks are up or down? A friend is pregnant with twins that she knows are fraternal. What are the chances that at least one of the babies is a girl? When you drive by a dead skunk in the road, why does it take about 10 seconds before you smell it? Assume that you did not actually drive over the skunk. Apparently, Americans are a very practical people. The thing to note here is that each of the queries has a certain scientific or mathematical component to it, a characteristic of many of the questions answered in the column. One might ask, especially if one knows a little something about mathematics and science, who is this guru, Marilyn? Well, Marilyn is Marilyn Vos Savant, famous for being listed for years in the Guinness World Records Hall of Fame as the person with the world's highest recorded IQ, 228. She is also famous for being married to Robert Jarvik, inventor of the Jarvik artificial heart. But sometimes famous people, despite their other accomplishments, are remembered for something they wished had never happened. As in, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. That may be the case for Marilyn, who is now most famous for her response to the following question, which appeared in her column one Sunday in September 1990. I have altered the wording slightly. Suppose the contestants on a game show are given the choice of three doors. Behind one door is a car, behind the others, goats. After a contestant picks a door, the host, who knows what's behind all the doors, opens one of the unchosen doors, which reveals a goat. He then says to the contestant, "Do you want to switch to the other unopened door?" Is it to the contestant's advantage to make the switch? The question was inspired by the workings of the television game show Let's Make a Deal, which ran from 1963 to 1976, and in several incarnations from 1980 to 1991. The show's main draw was its handsome, amiable host, Monty Hall, and his provocatively clad assistant, Carol Merrill, Miss Azusa, California of 1957. It had come as a surprise to the show's creators that after airing 4,500 episodes in nearly 27 years, it was this question of mathematical probability that would be their principal legacy. This issue has immortalized both Marilyn and Let's Make a Deal because of the vehemence with which Marilyn Vos Savant's readers responded to the column. After all, it appears to be a pretty silly question. Two doors are available. Open one, and you win. Open the other, and you lose. So it seems self-evident that whether you change your choice or not, your chances of winning are 50-50, which could be simpler. The thing is, Marilyn said in her column, that it is better to switch. Despite the public's much-heralded lethargy when it comes to mathematical issues, Marilyn's readers reacted as if she'd advocated ceding California back to Mexico. Her denial of the obvious brought her an avalanche of mail, 10,000 letters by her estimate. If you ask the American people whether they agree that plants create the oxygen in the air, light travels faster than sound, or you cannot make radioactive milk safe by boiling it, you will get double-digit disagreement in each case. 13%, 24%, and 35%, respectively. But on this issue, Americans were united. 92% agreed. Marilyn was wrong. Many readers seemed to feel let down. How could a person they trusted on such a broad range of issues be confused by such a simple question? Was her mistake a symbol of woeful ignorance of the American people? Almost 1,000 PhDs wrote in, many of them math professors who seemed to be especially irate. "You blew it," wrote a mathematician from George Mason University. "Let me explain. If one door is shown to be a loser, that information changes the probability of either remaining choice, neither of which has any reason to be more likely, to 1 in 2. As a professional mathematician, I'm very concerned with the general public's lack of mathematical skills. Please help by confessing your error, and in the future, being more careful." From Dickinson State University came this: "I am shocked that after being corrected by at least 3 mathematicians, you still do not see your mistake." From Georgetown: "How many irate mathematicians are needed to change your mind?" And someone from the U.S. Army Research Institute remarked, "If all those PhDs are wrong, the country would be in serious trouble." Responses continued in such great numbers, and for such a long time, that after devoting quite a bit of column space to the issue, Marilyn decided she would no longer address it. The Army PhD who wrote in may have been correct that if all those PhDs were wrong, it would be a sign of trouble. But Marilyn was correct. When told of this, Paul Erdos, one of the leading mathematicians of the 20th century, said, "That's impossible." Then, when presented with a formal mathematical proof of the correct answer, he still didn't believe it and grew angry. Only after a colleague arranged for a computer simulation in which Erdos watched hundreds of trials that came out 2-1 in favor of switching, did Erdos concede he was wrong. How can something that seems so obvious be wrong? In the words of a Harvard professor who specializes in probability and statistics, "Our brains are just not wired to do probability problems very well." The great American physicist, Richard Feynman, once told me never to think I understand a work in physics if all I had done was read someone else's derivation. "The only way to really understand a theory," he said, is to derive it yourself, or, perhaps, end up disproving it. For those of us who aren't Feynman, reproving other people's work is a good way to end up untenured and plying our math skills as a checker at Home Depot. But the Monty Hall problem is one of those that can be solved without any specialized mathematical knowledge. You don't need calculus, geometry, algebra, or even amphetamines, which Erdos was reportedly fond of taking. As legend has it, once after quitting for a month, he remarked, "Before, when I looked at a piece of blank paper, my mind was filled with ideas. Now all I see is a blank piece of paper." All you need is a basic understanding of how probability works and the law of the sample space, that framework for analyzing chance situations that was first put on paper in the 16th century by Girolamo Cardano. Girolamo Cardano was no rebel breaking forth from the intellectual milieu of 16th century Europe. To Cardano, a dog's howl portended the death of a loved one, and a few ravens croaking on the roof meant a grave illness was on its way. He believed as much as anyone else in fate, in luck, and in seeing your future and the alignment of planets and stars. Still, had he played poker, he wouldn't have been found drawing to an inside straight. For Cardano, gambling was second nature. His feeling for it was seated in his gut, not in his head. And so his understanding of the mathematical relationships among a game's possible random outcomes transcended his belief that, owing to fate, any such insight is futile. Cardano's work also transcended the primitive state of mathematics in his day, for algebra and even arithmetic were yet in their Stone Age in the early 16th century, preceding even the invention of the equal sign. History has much to say about Cardano, based on both his autobiography and the writings of some of his contemporaries. Some of the writings are contradictory, but one thing is certain. Born in 1501, Girolamo Cardano was not a child you'd have put your money on. His mother, Chiara, despised children, though, or perhaps because, she already had three boys. Short, stout, hot-tempered, and promiscuous, she prepared a kind of 16th-century morning-after pill when she became pregnant with Girolamo, a brew of wormwood, burned barleycorn, and tamarisk root. She drank it down in an attempt to abort the fetus. The brew sickened her, but the unborn Girolamo was unfazed, perfectly content with whatever metabolites the concoction left in his mother's bloodstream. Her other attempts met with similar failure. Chiara and Girolamo's father, Fazio Cardano, were not married, but they often acted as if they were. They were known for their many loud quarrels. A month before Girolamo's birth, Chiara left their home in Milan to live with her sister in Pavia, 20 miles to the south. Girolamo emerged after 3 days of painful labor. One look at the infant, and Chiara must have thought she would be rid of him after all. He was frail, and worse, lay silent. Chiara's midwife predicted he'd be dead within the hour. But if Chiara was thinking, good riddance, she was let down again, for the baby's wet nurse soaked him in a bath of warm wine, and Girolamo revived. The infant's good health lasted only a few months, however. Then he, his nurse, and his three half-brothers all came down with the plague. The Black Death, as the plague is sometimes called, is really three distinct diseases: bubonic, pneumonic, and septicemic plague. Cardano contracted bubonic, the most common, named for the buboes, the painful egg-sized swellings of the lymph nodes that are one of the disease's prominent symptoms. Life expectancy, once buboes appeared, was about a week. The Black Death had first entered Europe through a harbor in Messina, in northeastern Sicily in 1347, carried by a Genoese fleet returning from the Orient. The fleet was quickly quarantined, and the entire crew died aboard the ship. But the rats survived and scurried ashore, carrying both the bacteria and the fleas that would spread them. The ensuing outbreak killed half the city within 2 months, and eventually between 25% and 50% of the population of Europe. Successive epidemics kept coming, tamping down the population of Europe for centuries. The year 1501 was a bad one for the plague in Italy. Girolamo's nurse and brothers died. The lucky baby got away with nothing but disfigurement, warts on his nose, forehead, cheeks, and chin. He was destined to live nearly 75 years. Along the way, there was plenty of disharmony, and in his early years, a good many beatings. Girolamo's father was a bit of an operator. A sometime pal of Leonardo da Vinci's, he was by profession a geometer. Never a profession that brought in much cash. Fazio often had trouble making the rent, so he started a consulting business, providing the highborn with advice on law and medicine. That enterprise eventually thrived, aided by Fazio's claim that he was descended from a brother of a fellow named Goffredo Castigliano of Milan, better known as Pope Celestine IV. When Girolamo reached the age of 5, his father brought him into the business, in a manner of speaking. That is, he strapped a pannier to his son's back, stuffed it with heavy legal and medical books, and began dragging the young boy to meetings with his patrons all over town. Girolamo would later write that, "From time to time as we walked the streets, my father would command me to stop while he opened a book and, using my head as a table, read some long passage, prodding me the while with his foot to keep still if I wearied of the great weight." In 1516, Girolamo decided his best opportunity lay in the field of medicine and announced that he wanted to leave his family's home in Milan and travel back to Pavia to study there. Fazio wanted him to study law, however, because then he would become eligible for an annual stipend of 100 crowns. After a huge family brawl, Fazio relented. But the question remained, without the stipend, how would Girolamo support himself in Pavia? He began to save the money he earned reading horoscopes and tutoring pupils in geometry, alchemy, and astronomy. Somewhere along the way, he noticed he had a talent for gambling, a talent that would bring him cash much faster than any of those other means. For anyone interested in gambling in Cardano's day, every city was Las Vegas. On cards, dice, backgammon, even chess, wagers were made everywhere. Cardano classified these games according to two types: those that involved some strategy or skill, and those that were governed by pure chance. In games like chess, Cardano risked being outplayed by some 16th-century Bobby Fischer. But when he bet on the fall of a couple of small cubes, his chances were as good as anyone else's. And yet, in those games he did have an advantage because he had developed a better understanding of the odds of winning in various situations than any of his opponents. And so for his entree into the betting world, Cardano played the games of pure chance. Before long, he had set aside over 1,000 crowns for his education, more than a decade's worth of the stipend his father wanted for him. In 1520, he registered as a student in Pavia. Soon after, he began to write down his theory of gambling. Living when he did, Cardano had the advantage of understanding many things that had been Greek to the Greeks and to the Romans, for the Hindus had taken the first large steps toward employing arithmetic as a powerful tool. It was in that milieu that positional notation in base 10 developed and became standard around AD 700. The Hindus also made great progress in the arithmetic of fractions, something crucial to the analysis of probabilities, since the chances of something occurring are always less than one. This Hindu knowledge was picked up by the Arabs and eventually brought to Europe. There, the first abbreviations, the letter P for plus and the letter M for minus, were used in the 15th century. The symbols plus and minus were introduced around the same time by the Germans, but only to indicate excess and deficient weights of chests. It gives one a feeling for some of the challenges Cardano faced to note that the equal sign did not yet exist, to be invented in 1557. By Robert Record of Oxford and Cambridge, who, inspired by geometry, remarked that no things could be more nearly alike than parallel lines, and hence decided that such lines should denote equality. and the symbol X for multiplication, attributable to an Anglican minister, didn't arrive on the scene until the 17th century. Cardano's Book on Games of Chance covers card games, dice, backgammon, and astragali. It is not perfect. In its pages are reflected Cardano's character, his crazy ideas, his wild temper, the passion with which he approached every undertaking, and the turbulence of his life and times. It considers only process, such as the toss of a die or the dealing of a playing card, in which one outcome is as likely as another. And some points Cardano gets wrong. Still, the Book on Games of Chance represents a beachhead, the first success in the human quest to understand the nature of uncertainty. And Cardano's method of attacking questions of chance is startling both in its power and in its simplicity. Not all the chapters of Cardano's book treat technical issues. For instance, chapter 26 is titled, "Do Those Who Teach Well Also Play Well?" He concludes, "It seems to be a different thing to know and to execute." Chapter 29 is called, "On the Character of Players." "There are some who, with many words, drive both themselves and others from their proper senses." These seem more "Dear Abby" than "Ask Marilyn." But then there is chapter 14, "On Combined Points, on Possibilities." There, Cardano states what he calls a general rule, our law of the sample space. The term sample space refers to the idea that the possible outcomes of a random process can be thought of as the points in a space. In simple cases, the space might consist of just a few points, but in more complex situations, it can be a continuum, just like the space we live in. Cardano didn't call it a space, however. The notion that a set of numbers could form a space was a century off, awaiting the genius of Descartes, his invention of coordinates, and his unification of algebra and geometry. In modern language, Cardano's rule reads like this. Suppose a random process has many equally likely outcomes, some favorable, that is, winning, some unfavorable, losing. Then the probability of obtaining a favorable outcome is equal to the proportion of outcomes that are favorable. The set of all possible outcomes is called the sample space. In other words, if a die can land on any six sides, those six outcomes form the sample space, and if you place a bet on, say, two of them, your chances of winning are 2 in 6. A word on the assumption that all the outcomes are equally likely. Obviously, that's not always true. The sample space for observing Oprah Winfrey's adult weight runs, historically, from 145 pounds to 237 pounds. And over time, not all weight intervals have proved equally likely. The complication that different possibilities have different probabilities can be accounted for by associating the proper odds with each possible outcome, that is, by careful accounting. But for now, we'll look at examples in which all outcomes are equally probable, like those Cardano analyzed. The potency of Cardano's rule goes hand in hand with certain subtleties. One lies in the meaning of the term outcomes. As late as the 18th century, the famous French mathematician Jean-Laurent d'Alembert, author of several works on probability, misused the concept when he analyzed the toss of two coins. The number of heads that turns up in those two tosses can be 0, 1, or 2. Since there are three outcomes, Alembert reasoned, the chances of each must be 1 in 3. But Alembert was mistaken. One of the greatest deficiencies of Cardano's work was that he made no systematic analysis of the different ways in which a series of events, such as coin tosses, can turn out. As we shall see in the next chapter, no one did that until the following century. Still, a series of two coin tosses is simple enough that Cardano's methods are easily applied. The key is to realize that the possible outcomes of coin flipping are the data describing how the two coins land, not the total number of heads calculated from that data, as in Alembert's analysis. In other words, we should not consider zero, one, or two heads as the possible outcomes, but rather the sequences. Heads, 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 tails, tails, heads, and tails, tails. These are the four possibilities that make up the sample space. The next step, according to Cardano, is to sort through the outcomes, cataloging the number of heads we can harvest from each. Only one of the four outcomes, heads, heads, yields two heads. Similarly, only tails, tails yields zero heads. But if we desire one head, then two of the outcomes are favorable, heads, tails, and tails, heads. And so, Cardano's method shows that Alembert was wrong. The chances are 25% for zero or two heads, but 50% for one head. Had Cardano laid his cash on one head at 3-1, he would have lost only half the time, but tripled his money the other half. A great opportunity for a 16th century kid trying to save up money for college. And still a great opportunity today, if you can find anyone offering it. A related problem often taught in elementary probability courses is the $2 problem, which is similar to one of the questions I quoted from the Ask Maryland column. Suppose a mother is carrying fraternal twins and wants to know the odds of having two girls, a boy and a girl, and so on. Then the sample space consists of all the possible lists of the sexes of the children in their birth order: girl, 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 boy, boy, girl, and boy, boy. It is the same as the space for the coin toss problem, except for the way we name the points. Heads becomes girl, and tails becomes boy. Mathematicians have a fancy name for the situation in which one problem is another in disguise. They call it an isomorphism. When you find an isomorphism, it often means you've saved yourself a lot of work. In this case, it means we can figure the chances that both children will be girls in exactly the same way we figured the chances of both tosses coming up heads in the coin toss problem. And so without even doing the analysis, we know that the answer is the same, 25%. We can now answer the question asked in Marilyn's column. The chance that at least one of the babies will be a girl is the chance that both will be girls plus the chance that one will be a girl. That is, 25% plus 50%, which is 75%. In the two-daughter problem, an additional question is usually asked. What are the chances, given that one of the children is a girl, that both children will be girls? One might reason this way. Since it is given that one of the children is a girl, there is only one child left to look at. The chance of that child's being a girl is 50%, so the probability that both children are girls is 50%. That is not correct. Why? Although the statement of the problem says that one child is a girl, it doesn't say which one, and that changes things. If that sounds confusing, that's okay, because it provides a good illustration of the power of Cardano's method, which makes the reasoning clear. The new information, one of the children is a girl, means that we are eliminating from consideration the possibility that both children are boys. And so, employing Cardano's approach, we eliminate the possible outcome boy-boy from the sample space. That leaves only three outcomes in the sample space: girl-boy, boy-girl, and girl-girl. Of these, only girl-girl is the favorable outcome, that is, both children are daughters. So the chances that both children are girls is 1 in 3, or 33%. Now we can see why it matters that the statement of the problem didn't specify which child was a daughter. For instance, if the problem had asked for the chances of both children being girls, given that the first child is a girl, then we would have eliminated both boy-boy and boy-girl from the sample space, and the odds would have been 1 in 2, or 50%. One has to give credit to Marilyn Vossevant not only for attempting to raise public understanding of elementary probability, but also for having the courage to continue to publish such questions, even after her frustrating Monty Hall experience. We will end this discussion with another question taken from her column, this one from March 1996. My dad heard this story on the radio. At Duke University, two students had received A's in chemistry all semester. But on the night before the final exam, they were partying in another state and didn't get back to Duke until it was over. Their excuse to the professor was that they had a flat tire, and they asked if they could take a makeup test. The professor agreed, wrote out a test, and sent the two to separate rooms to take it. The first question, on one side of the paper, was worth 5 points. Then they flipped the paper over and found the second question worth 95 points. The question? Which tire was it? What was the probability that both students would say the same thing? My dad and I think it's 1 in 16. Is that right? No, it is not. If the students were lying, the correct probability of their choosing the same answer is 1 in 4. And now that we're accustomed to decomposing a problem into lists of possibilities, we are ready to employ the law of the sample space to tackle the Monty Hall problem. As I said earlier, understanding the Monty Hall problem requires no mathematical training, but it does require some careful logical thought. So if you are listening to this while watching Simpsons reruns, you might want to postpone one activity or the other. The good news is, it goes on for only a few pages. In the Monty Hall problem, you are facing three doors. Behind one door is something valuable, say, a shiny red Maserati. Behind the other two, an item of far less interest, say, the complete works of Shakespeare in Serbian. You have chosen door number one. The sample space in this case is the list of three possible outcomes. Maserati behind door number one, Maserati behind door number two, and Maserati behind door number three. Each one of these has a probability of 1 in 3. Since the assumption is that most people would prefer the Maserati, the first case is the winning case, and your chances of having guessed right are 1 in 3. Now, according to the problem, the next thing that happens is that the host, who knows what's behind all the doors, opens one you did not choose, revealing one of the sets of Shakespeare. In opening this door, the host has used what he knows to avoid revealing the Maserati, so this is not a completely random process. There are two cases to consider. One is the case in which your initial choice was correct. Let's call that the lucky guess scenario. The host will now randomly open door number two or door number three. And if you choose to switch, instead of enjoying a fast, sexy ride, you'll be the owner of Troilus and Cressida in the Torlakian dialect. In the lucky guess scenario, you are better off not switching. But the probability of landing in the lucky guess scenario is only 1 in 3. The other case we must consider is that in which your initial choice was wrong. We'll call that the wrong guess scenario. The chances you guessed wrong are 2 out of 3. So the wrong guess scenario is twice as likely to occur as the lucky guess scenario. How does the wrong guess scenario differ from the lucky guess scenario? In the wrong guess scenario, the Maserati is behind one of the doors you did not choose, and a copy of the Serbian Shakespeare is behind the other unchosen door. Unlike the lucky guess scenario, in this scenario, the host does not randomly open an unchosen door. Since he does not want to reveal the Maserati, he chooses to open precisely the door that does not have the Maserati behind it. In other words, in the wrong guess scenario, the host intervenes in what until now has been a random process. So the process is no longer random. The host uses his knowledge to bias the result, violating randomness by guaranteeing that if you switch your choice, you will get the fancy red car. Because of this intervention, you will find yourself in the wrong guess scenario. You will win if you switch, and lose if you don't. To summarize, if you are in the lucky guess scenario, probability 1 in 3, you'll win if you stick with your choice. If you are in the wrong guess scenario, probability 2 in 3, Owing to the actions of the host, you will win if you switch your choice. And so your decision comes down to a guess. In which scenario do you find yourself? If you feel that ESP or fate has guided your initial choice, maybe you shouldn't switch. But unless you can bend silver spoons into pretzels with your brainwaves, the odds are 2-1 that you are in the wrong guess scenario. And so it is better to switch. Statistics from the television program bear this out. Those who found themselves in the situation described in the problem and switched their choice won about twice as often as those who did not.